Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura Mize and Kate Hensler. I think I said our last names, but I don't usually do that. today is Thursday, July 23rd, and we'd like to welcome you to our show. Kate, you want to introduce yourself while I regain my composure?
Sure, that would be great. I'm Kate Hensler, and I'm a developmental interventionist with an early intervention program in Kentucky called First Steps. And I work with Laura now and again. I'm always happy to because our kids typically do well. She's a great speech therapist and an even better friend.
Oh, that was very sweet. Okay, tonight I'm on the road once again. This has been the summer of short trips. And we're going to pick up where we left off last week. We're talking about apraxia, which is a speech disorder in children. Well, it can be in adults too, but tonight we're talking about in young children, and we're really kind of contrasting that or comparing that with phonological disorders, which is usually when a child goes to see a speech language pathologist and they've been identified as having a particular speech problem. Apraxia and phonological disorders are the biggies that therapists often try to distinguish if they're looking at a specific diagnosis. What exactly is going on with the child? And last week we defined we defined apraxia as a motor planning disorder, and it's actually the very clinical definition is that it's a neurological speech disorder. It affects the child's ability to plan, execute, and sequence the movements of the mouth necessary for intelligible speech. And so, again, with motor planning, that means that as a child is getting ready to talk, he has the message in his brain, and somehow, for lack of a better term, it short circuits and he can't plan it, execute it, sequence the movements of his mouth to be able to say that word where you can understand it. And so, again, if you haven't listened to our show last week, we went into great detail about the characteristics that children have who go on to be diagnosed with that. And one other thing that we talked about is that it's a little bit of a controversial diagnosis for toddlers because lots of professionals believe that children should really be over 3 before they are officially diagnosed with apraxia so that it's a pretty firm diagnosis. And again, I can go back and forth on that and talk about that with anybody. On one day I might say, oh, I totally agree with that. And then on another day I might take a more practical approach like my friend Kate, who always says, if it looks like a duck and acts like a duck, why don't you just call it a duck? So, I
true. Only to you, though. I only say that to you.
Well, and I tell all your secrets here.
I know you do,
secrets.
Don't you?
I know. I'm glad you don't do that to me. You're a better friend than I am in that regard. So, but lots of speech pathologists, again, are pretty hesitant to diagnose a child with apraxia because, one, they want to see how he starts to sound once he talks so that they can analyze the patterns of errors. If a child is having lots of difficulties that look like it's going to be apraxia, the main thing you want your speech pathologist to do is go ahead and use the strategies that are effective. Because I think it really doesn't matter to me whether it's apraxia or a phonological disorder. The big thing would be whether it's a speech disorder like apraxia or phonological disorders or a language disorder, meaning that it's just an issue with vocabulary and with more of a language or kind of a more of conceptual problem rather than I can't get the words out. So, again, we could talk about that. We talked about the difference between speech and language disorders last week, right?
I don't know
did
that
we did.
Yeah, I'm listening. I'm trying to remember. I don't think we did in much detail, if at all, Laura, really.
You know, when speech pathologists assess children, and Kate, you know, you're as a developmental interventionist, you do some of this too, we look at speech and language. A lot of people use those terms interchangeably, but speech pathologists really don't. Speech refers to speech sound production or the specific sounds to make up a word. Whereas language is about what the words mean, and again, the vocabulary, you would look at early grammar in there, which speech pathologists would call syntax. The vocabulary part, our professional term for that would be semantics. you look at those kinds of things. And, you know, language then is also broken down into receptive language, what a child understands, versus expressive language, what the gestures the child uses or how he communicates with words. So, again, there's a difference between speech, a speech disorder, and a language disorder. And so what we're talking about tonight, speech disorders like apraxia and phonological disorders really are different from language disorders. But in toddlers, you often don't know which one it is, do you, when you're evaluating them, whether it's a true speech disorder or a little bit of a language delay, or most of the time it's both. You know, they're
right.
having problems learning language, and there's some kind of speech component going on as well with specific sounds and forming words that other people, mostly mommy and daddy, can understand. I feel like I just kind of ran through a bunch of information. There might be questions on that. Just from that brief explanation, Kate, do you think there's anything we need to kind of reiterate with that?
Makes sense to me, but we, you and I talk about these things so much.
Right.
You
know, and I think from a parent's perspective, I think a lot of parents really think about speech and language as the same thing. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and really, 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 in the truest sense of the word, it's not. I mean, if you are looking at the big, big picture as far as communication goes, I can see where a parent would really think about that. But, you know, when you take them to a specialist like the speech-language pathologist, you really kind of want to tease that out and decide what's going on. And I think it's important for parents to really try to wrap their arms around the definitions so that they can understand exactly what a professional is saying to them. And if you don't know exactly what they're saying, you need to stop them and say, I'm not sure what you mean by that term, or explain that to me again in a way that I can understand it, or please don't use so much jargon or professional lingo when you're talking to me about this. Back up and explain this to me again so that you can understand exactly what's going on with your child. And I think it's pretty common for parents to say it's a speech delay when it might be a language delay, or most more often than not with toddlers it's both. There's a speech component and a language component with that.
Yes, and I think that they recognize the speech thing because that's kind of the obvious thing to, you know, that is obvious to parents and obvious to friends, and, you know, he doesn't talk, does he? Or he talks very little, or, but,
right.
And I think we've, and not to be on a negative note, but in the past we've certainly mentioned that some parents recognize the speech problem and not the language problem.
Right.
And
you know, and how I talk to parents about that is when I would think about a child really primarily as having a language disorder is when there's when he's not really, gosh, and even if I say this, I think, no, that's a bad way to put it, but if a child's not really trying to talk at all, sometimes there really is a speech component to that, like apraxia. There's always the language is the biggest component when the child's not following directions or not understanding or not even really trying to communicate. You know, that would be that he's not using any gestures. He's not making his intent known even without words. You know, that to me is more of a language issue. He doesn't get the whole communication piece. Whereas I would think about a child being just speech disordered when he's trying to talk, but you have no clue what he's saying, you know, and trying to use things that sound like real words and not just, even as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, oh, wait, but what about those kids that use jargon when it's really receptive language problems? So I probably totally muddied the water by trying to just kind of talk about this off the top of my head without an organized script for tonight. So let's just back up and say that speech and language disorders are separate, and if you're having a hard time deciding which one or both, you know, have a good conversation with your child's speech language pathologist about that so that you can really understand exactly what your child's issues are. And it's so hard to kind of talk in hypothetical terms when you're not talking about a specific child too, don't you think?
I do.
Yeah, because you always come up with these exceptions, and I think, oh, wait, but I can't say that because blah, 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 so.
Well, and also, Laura, like you've already hinted at, a lot of times these things do kind of present themselves in conjunction with other things, and in theory, they make it sound very clear when you're reading what the experts say about apraxia, what they say about phonological disorders. And in practice, it's not always so clear.
Right.
Even to a learned ear, it can be, there are sometimes some combinations in there where it's
yeah.
a touch of this and a touch of that, really. So.
Well, and that's what we talked about last week, with
mm-hmm.
this not being an exact objective measure. I mean, there is no blood test to tell you whether a child has a speech disorder, a language disorder, a language delay, a speech delay. There, you know, there's no objective black and white way to do that. Really, it's the experience and the kind of the clinical assessment that you get from your speech pathologist, who gives you her best estimation of what she thinks the initial problem is when she first meets your child. And I always feel like children, as they mature, you know, you kind of feel like you're solving a puzzle or you're unraveling exactly what's going on. You know, I have some children that I feel like they're so complex that, you know, you peel back layer after layer after layer and try to think, like you said, he's got a little of this and a little of that. And, you know, it hardly ever is as black and white as we try to make it be on, you know, when we're talking about it in such general terms. But for a specific child, you probably could speak about it much more coherently than I'm trying to do right now. Okay.
It does make sense to me, but it is a confusing topic. So, and like I said last week too, sometimes they have to even make a little bit of progress, you know,
right.
you know, before you really even get some idea, well, what is it going to look like once he's trying to talk?
Right.
Because I think sometimes their little personalities get factored in there, and you really got to kind of get over the initial hump to get them making some effort to communicate on some level so that you can see, well, what's it going to look like when he is beginning to talk.
Well, and that's what lots of experts say. And last week I talked about...
Really? I like it. I thought I said that. Okay.
But, you know, that's what last week we were talking about, how some experts really say that you can't really diagnose apraxia until 3.
Right.
Or, like we were talking about Caroline Bowen, which is a speech pathologist, or who is a speech pathologist from Australia, and she has a great site that we talked about last week. It's speech-language-therapy.com, and somewhere on there, on the site, she gives a guideline of the vocabulary size that she would want a child to have before she really made an official diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking she says 50 to 100 words, and I don't have that right in front of me, so if I'm misrepresenting that, I'm totally sorry about that, but she really wants to hear a child talk for a good long while. Sometimes it takes a while to get to those 50 to 100 words. You know, a kid might be 3, 3 and a half.
Especially if they're really apraxic, huh, Laura?
Yeah. I mean, you could be darn near 4 and not have that many words.
Right. And I think, I don't know if it was on her site, because frankly, I haven't looked at her site in recent times, but way back when I was researching things online just for my own knowledge, I read something about... to diagnose apraxia, one therapist, and it probably was Carolyn Bowen, but I'm not saying it was, said something like, really, they should, it has to be a very long-term concern or issue for the child. I mean, they were talking about years of, and I thought, well, some of the kids that I've worked with, and even some of those who have gotten a formal diagnosis from, say, Weisskopf Child Evaluation Center or something, they're looking pretty darn good by 3 or 4, and
right.
this was saying they would have to be in therapy for, you know, I don't know how, something like 8 years or 10 years, or, and they were giving
yeah.
an age. You know, they were saying basically unless this is such a persistent problem that they're well into their teens and still having issues, it wasn't apraxia. And I think that's a really extreme look at apraxia myself, but...
I think so, too. And mm-hmm. the reason, again... that you want to sort of identify it, even if you're not really officially calling it that, is so that you're doing the techniques that work, and
right.
the appropriate therapy techniques, and so that you're not just treating it like it's a language disorder and just doing language facilitation techniques without adding that motor speech component. So, you know, my philosophy and, you know, the stuff that we talk about all the time, Kate, is so we've kind of gone the other way and almost use all of the motor speech things and even some of the phonological disorder treatment strategies to treat all of our toddlers because those things work. And they certainly, if it's just a language disorder, it's going to come along pretty fast, even using those motor speech things. But with the opposite approach, if you're just using language facilitation techniques with a kid who really has a motor speech disorder, they're not going to make very much progress at all.
Right.
You know, I like the whole, and we've talked about this before, the Hayden Center approach, the observe, wait, and listen, and all the stuff that's in It Takes Two to Talk. All that is great if it's just a language disorder. But you take a kid with all those characteristics that we talked about last week, all those red flags for apraxia, you can observe, wait, and listen all you want to, and nothing's going to happen. And we've talked about that before, too, where we'll pick up kids later, or, you know, you might be serving on a team with a speech pathologist who has pretty much that approach. And you can imitate them and walk around all day narrating what they're doing and might not get anywhere for months doing that, whereas you implement some of these other things like signs and doing some of the other really specific techniques that we're going to talk about, and they start to come along and do pretty well. So, again, there's danger in not thinking that it's a motor speech disorder like apraxia or even, you know, a phonological disorder and not implementing the things that work because you could waste valuable treatment time.
Mm-hmm. And the danger in treating it, I guess there's no danger in treating it like it's apraxia, but there is some professional danger in saying all language-delayed kids are too many, you know, an inordinate number of language-delayed 2 and 3-year-olds are apraxic because you're really over-diagnosing it. But if you go on and treat it like it is, you're going to have good success regardless. So
that's what I think. And I've heard I've heard really famous people kind of say that. Nancy Kaufman in the last apraxia workshop that I went to a year or so ago, I guess it was longer than that now, said, you know, what's the danger in doing that? You pop them in therapy when they're 2, 2 and a half, you look like a genius because
Right. They
come along so fast.
Right.
You know, if it's just been a language disorder, what's the harm in that?
And I've certainly seen those kids in practice that I thought, I never said that I thought they were apraxic, but I did, they had some tendencies in that direction, and in my mind I thought, yeah, could be apraxia, and then they did make really fast progress, and I thought, well, maybe it wasn't. But parents were happy, I was happy, the child did really well, so it didn't really matter because
right. We
did what worked, so hey, great.
Good. Yeah, and you're just keeping the big picture in mind when it's that. So don't, you know, if therapists are listening, don't feel like there's harm in kind of implementing some of these things, even if you're not sure exactly what's that it is a motor-based or a motor planning disorder because, you know, no harm in going that way. So,
right.
Okay. Let's talk about phonological disorders. You know, last week I think we briefly talked about that it's difficulty with the rules or the patterns for combining sounds to make intelligible words. And there are lots of different phonological processes that we look at, and that really, you know, even children with typically developing speech exhibit these phonological processes when they're learning how to talk. So the problem is when their little peers that are the same age are maturing and adapting more complex ways of speaking and using lots of different sounds and new patterns, and then a child is kind of stuck and sounding like a much younger child and not progressing and adding those new sounds or new patterns so that he, again, doesn't sound like his little peers who are moving right along. So that's when it becomes a problem. And I think sometimes as a parent of an 18-month-old or a 24-month-old, you might read these and think, oh, no, my kid has all those phonological processes. And I say, yeah, because he's 20 months. He's supposed to. So, again, don't get so hung up on some of these things when we're talking about it, because some of the processes really do happen with all children, and again, maturation usually takes care of those issues so that those sounds and patterns are coming on in, and the problem becomes when children aren't maturing in that way. So we can talk about just some of those examples. I'd hoped that I would have my big list of those so we could sit through some of them, but as I said earlier, I am not at home tonight, so that's been a little hard for me to come up with, but let's talk about just some of the big ones that affect lots of children. Final consonant deletion would be a phonological process that lots of children have until they're 2.5 or 3, and that would mean that they leave off all ending sounds. And again, the reason that you would think about this as a phonological process or a phonological disorder is because you can identify that pattern. He never includes a final sound in a word, whereas a kid with apraxia may have final sounds in some words but not in other words. And that happens, too, even with kids with typically developing speech. So you don't just wake up all of a sudden the day you turn 3 and you have every final consonant in place. It's, you know, takes a few weeks or months for that to kind of happen, but when you're looking at a child with a phonological disorder, you notice, okay, there's a distinct pattern here. He never has an ending sound. Does that make sense?
It does to me. Laura, can I interject a surprise question?
Sure.
Because I really am wondering this, which will reveal my level of understanding here, but that's okay.
Well, listen, but let me clarify. You really shouldn't know about phonological disorders. Not that you shouldn't know about it in a professional capacity, but you're not a speech pathologist. You're a developmental interventionist. You concentrate on cognition and on social skills and fine motor and things like that. So I don't want any listener or especially you feeling like, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about, because you shouldn't. You're not a speech pathologist. So
well, I get the theory, but this is just something I was, stream of consciousness in my head. I'm going to ask you. What is the difference between when a speech therapist says an articulation disorder or a phonological disorder?
It's just kind of a philosophical difference, because articulation disorder is kind of in the history of how speech language pathology has evolved. Articulation disorder was when the sounds were in the wrong places. You know, we classified that as you had omissions, substitutions, and deletions.
Okay.
And omissions meant that it's never there.
Mm-hmm.
Distortions, I'm sorry. Omissions, it's never there. Substitutions, you use one sound for another. And then distortions is where the sound is almost right, like a lisp. You know that that's
okay.
But you know,
right.
It's like sunshine for sunshine.
Okay.
Okay. So articulation disorders really are looking at sounds on a sound-by-sound basis. Like, we still, as pediatric speech pathologists, give the Goldman-Fristo test of articulation, which kind of looks at sounds, individual sounds that might look at, say, a K sound. Can a kid make a K sound at the beginning of the word key? Can he do it at the end of the word kick? Does he have it in the middle of the word cookie? So, again, that's looking at a child's speech on a sound-by-sound basis and deciding, okay, he has an articulation disorder because he can't do L and he can't do S and he can't do R. Okay, a phonological disorder is when you start looking at a kid on a pattern level, whereas
okay.
You would say, okay, you wouldn't really say, these are the sounds that he omits and always in the final position, because you would say, oh, gosh, there's a better way to classify that. There's a broader pattern here. It's not that he can't just do K, D, T, P, M, S, L, R in the last position in a word. You know, you would think, oh, it's not that. It's that he's leaving off all or most final consonants.
Okay.
So a phonological disorder is going to be that they're kind of looking at the big picture and trying to find real patterns there. And an articulation disorder would be either they're kind of using an old school way to classify a kid's errors. Or kind of, come up with that, or that they feel like it's just really isolated with a few sounds. Because like a
okay.
kid, like my little girl, her articulation was pretty good except for that persistent problem with R until she was darn near 8. So that was an articulation disorder because she didn't have problems with blends except when it had an R. she didn't have problems with other things. It was just that pesky R. So I wouldn't have looked at her and, said she had a phonological disorder because it just would have been that one sound. Does that
okay.
make more sense?
Yes, it does.
When you are hearing therapists talk about it, though, in early intervention, they're probably using the terms interchangeably.
Okay. I don't really hear, honestly, I hear people talk about articulation, not phonological disorders. I mean, much at all.
Well, and I think when they're talking about articulation, they just mean that intelligibility stinks.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so as a parent, when they would say, you know, I'm concerned about articulation, they're just saying we're going to work on sounds versus we're going to work on language or vocabulary.
Okay.
You know, and children with phonological disorders do have poor articulation skills.
Right.
So I think in that way, they're kind of using it interchangeably. But if you had an older kid and you were saying it's an articulation disorder versus a phonological disorder, that would be an articulation disorder would just be a few little isolated sounds, and a phonological mm-hmm. disorder would be the whole pattern is messed up. And remember we talked about last week how I kind of sort this out in my mind as a phonological disorder is that a kid is not organized in how he thinks about words or kind of knows about words. It's kind of a mind problem. And again, that's such a layman way to look at it. And, you know, that shows just how
now,
simple a girl I really am. You know, when you boil it down to that way, you know,
okay.
He hasn't organized his little system of sounds to know, gosh, that word needs a sound at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I've got to include, you know, a consonant blend has three little sounds there. It's not just that first sound that I hear. You know,
right.
It's kind of, you know, when I read about people that write about phonological disorders, you hear the phrase, it's in the mind, or it, I wish I was on the Bowen site because she says it so well, and I think I'm going to screw it up. But, she really talks about that it's an organization problem. They haven't sorted out exactly all these patterns yet.
Okay.
Am I making it any easier to understand? Another speech therapist is listening and wants to call and chime in if you want to do a better job explaining this. Knock yourself out.
Well, so far there's not, so you're it. You have to stick with it. It is these are pretty technical.
Right.
Not
but
the
as far
simplest
as
topics in the world, but
it's really not. And again, you know, I've done this for a long time and I have a hard time even kind of articulating when I'm not, again, reading from my specific notes that we wanted to talk about tonight. Okay, let's give some more examples of phonological processes. And again, they're not errors until a child of the same age would be including this. One common thing that we see with children, little kids like we see toddlers, is leaving off a syllable, like weak syllable reduction. So that would be instead of saying helicopter, they might say, you know, copter and leave off, or hecka, you know, leave off some of those syllables. You even have children that it's not necessarily a weak syllable, but they might only say the first syllable in a word. And when I see that, I would think, okay, this is more likely an apraxic kid than a phonologically disordered kid. But that's a process. And again, apraxia and phonological disorders are so commonly confused, even by therapists, and parents don't need to get all hung up on that if your speech pathologist is still kind of going back and forth on that, because you know, we've already touched on that tonight. Sometimes children do need to have started really talking before we can kind of sort out what it is. Okay, other errors might be, or kinds of phonological processes. Reduplication is one that we see often in young children where they simplify every word to, like, bubble is bubba, doggy is dog-dog, you know, where it's very repetitive. Have you had kids do that before, Kate? They try to...
Oh, yes, I have.
And, I mean, I've even had kids that go so far as even when it's not, when it's a word like car, they try to say car.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, really duplicate words that don't even have that pattern. So that's kind of their prevalent process that they have going on. Okay, let's see. I was looking for my other list, but unfortunately I don't have it on this computer. There are at least 5 different classification systems for a phonological process analysis. So sometimes where like in one test, like people can do the the Barbara Hodson phonological assessment, which was all the rage when I was in graduate school in the early, you know, late 80s, early 90s. There's the there are just lots of different kinds. So again, one person might call it final consonant deletion, and somebody else might call it post-vocalic consonant deletion. So again, don't get hung up on exactly the terms, because I think when people do a new test or a new analysis, they want to try to call it something different so that it's not just kind of a rehashing of the former test.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it kind of depends on what test you gave as to whether that's what you call a certain error. So as a parent, or, you know, as a therapist who's not a speech pathologist, don't get so hung up on that either. Just make sure you kind of understand what those things mean. Let's see, we've already talked about most of these processes, or all of them kind of go away on their own as children mature, and the problem is when a child is the same age and his little peers are moving on and he's not. And I do want to talk about this other point too. Sometimes children with a phonological disorder also have a language disorder, but I'm really comfortable with just calling a kid or saying that he has a phonological disorder when you know that he's making pretty good attempts at language. So he's trying to talk in these long sentences, but you really have no clue what he's saying. That, to me, with early talkers, you know, little bitty kids, is more indicative of phonological disorder rather than apraxia, because they can sequence so many sounds in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Does to me.
Okay.
I'm working with a little girl who sounds kind of like that.
Yeah, she's doing all the, she's really trying to talk, but you just don't know what she's saying.
Yes, but I mean, even her language has made great progress. She hasn't been in therapy too long, but now it's like, whoa, you know, she wasn't easy to understand when she was using single words, but now it's really getting harder because she's putting them together the way she's supposed to, but.
Yeah. And see, and then even as you say that, and even as I said that out loud, I'm thinking, oh, no, but is it because she's sequencing so many things in a row that it's really the apraxia? You know, and my clue there would be, does she always make the same kinds of errors? I mean, when she misarticulates a word or mispronounces a word, does it always sound the same, or does she change it every single time?
This little girl, I would say she tends to use the first part of most words, but chops off the end of lots of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, one word you can usually figure out, but boy, when she starts putting them together, unless you're totally with her on what she's talking about and she's kind of directing your attention and pointing, then you can kind of get it. But otherwise, she does seem to be more of a pattern kid, you know,
right.
Not a...
So mm-hmm. I would think about her more like phonological disorder than motor planning or apraxia.
Right. That's what she
yeah.
seems like. And I haven't had too many like her, but that's what she is, how she seems. So.
Well, that can be your compass from now on.
Yeah.
Kind of think about her in that way, or, you know, think about it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we should compare kids on your caseload, because one of my professors used to say all the time, okay, but where's typical, where's normal? You only compare kids to normal. You don't compare delayed and disordered kids to each other. You compare them to normal. You compare them to the milestones, so for what that's worth. Boy, I feel like I'm saying tonight everything I say, that I say but the exception. So anyway.
Well, Laura, to me it's the mark of a good therapist who realizes these things aren't really black and white. And certainly we have all dealt with families and parents who have had one person tell them one thing and another person tell them another thing. And, you know, that may be because there's a knowledge discrepancy between those therapists, and it may be because the subject is a bit gray. It just isn't that 100% clear. And you can have one... Even if you start researching these topics in depth, you'll get one interpretation with one expert and a slightly different or sometimes significantly different interpretation. I think you talked about Nancy Kaufman. If you compared what she said to Carolyn Bowen, I think you'd see a pretty big difference.
All right.
And they're both very highly respected speech therapists. So
right, and one is not right and one is not wrong. You
right.
know? So, yeah. And so I do think, you know, and we talked about last week kind of what your starting philosophical point would be. Caroline Bowen, I think, is the phonological guru, and Nancy Kaufman is the apraxia guru. And so, you know, one probably, not that they would look at the same kid and one see apraxia and one see phonological disorder, but, you know, just kind of from your knowledge base and from your area of expertise, you probably are going to pick that kid apart a little more in the area that you're really good at.
Or, and the truth is, Laura, at the end of the day, you and I care somewhat about this, I think, but mostly we care about what do you do to make it better, you know?
Right, right.
So
I don't really care why. He's not funny. I just want him to talk. And again, that's a very simplistic view. I do want to know so that I can do the right,
but
therapy techniques. But if it
you're
works,
not writing the test, you're not. You know what I mean? You're
right,
you're
yeah.
a practitioner, and you're about what works with each
yeah.
specific child. So
yeah, and
you know those are kind of theoretical positions, really. You know,
they really are. And as
mm-hmm.
far as intervention goes. If you're not having much luck with one therapy approach or therapy technique, you better believe after a few weeks I'm going to be switching to that other one because,
right.
again, that's what your point is. I don't really care what it is as much as I care about fixing it.
Right.
So, you know, you're going to really kind of zip through those things and figure out what's going to work for a particular child and then go with that.
Right, and not too many parents that I come in contact with anyway necessarily care that much about the I mean, they want to, you know, most parents generally want to know if there is a label for it or whatnot, but mostly they want to know what they can do and what you're going to do to help their child talk. So
right.
end of the day, they just want to know what works really too, mostly. So
right. Okay. Last week, did we start talking about the differences between apraxia and phonological disorders? Did we talk about those things that would help a speech pathologist clarify which one it is? Did we touch on that a little
really
bit?
I don't really think we did, Laura. I think we mostly just talked about apraxia, you know, kind of as
okay.
its own entity, and specifically what that looked like, and
okay.
that probably factors into the differences on some level, but we didn't specifically talk about the differences.
Yeah, and the reason that I can't remember is, you know, I am knee-deep in the DVD, Teach Me to Talk with Apraxia and Phonological Disorders, so I really, because I'm rereading that script all the time, you know, and I've been in the process of, for the last 2 or 3 weeks, trying to get those voiceovers done in between my bouts of laryngitis, as I'm about to break into my next coughing attack. So
it's very unfortunate timing on this little laryngitis bout, and it's been, it's not bad, but it's been hanging on for a while.
I know, today is the, like, 15th day, so that's why I'm having a hard time remembering. It's not early onset dementia or anything, it's just I am so engrossed in recording all of this, I can't remember what's the voiceover and what we actually talked about on the show, so sorry about that. Okay, as far as the diagnostic differences go, one thing that I always look at that I do think we talked about last week when we were talking about the identifying characteristics of apraxia is vowel sounds. Children who are or who go on to later be diagnosed with suspected apraxia of speech, especially in the beginning, make lots of substitutions with their vowel sounds. They might pick one vowel sound that's really neutral or easy for them to do, like and do it all the time. A child with a phonological disorder really doesn't mess up his vowels to the same degree that a kid with apraxia does. So that's always a clue for me. Even if a kid has lots of different consonants and lots of different vowels, in my mind, I kind of strike apraxia as early on. Now, not when he's 5 or 6, but when he's 2, if he has a pretty big sound repertoire of both vowels and consonants, and if in his word attempts, if I say please and he's hitting that E, I'm not always thinking that apraxia is the culprit for our speech mm-hmm. disorder. Now, I think we did talk about vowels a little bit last week, you know, just for parents who are thinking, oh, my goodness, what's the difference between a vowel and a consonant? Remember when you went to first grade and learned how to read, vowels are A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y, and, you know, remember your long vowels and your short vowels, and there are actually more vowel variations than that. There, you know, there's A, You know, you think about A as being, you know, long A, short A, but there are actually other ways to pronounce that too. We're not going to get kind of into the whole linguistic thing or a real phonological presentation about that, but just know that there are lots of different vowel sounds. And so if you have a child who is screwing up those vowels a lot, apraxia is probably more the suspected cause for that than a kid with a phonological disorder, because those kids are a lot more consistent with what they do, especially with their vowels.
Consistent, okay. you mean consistent, or do you mean they usually, vowels are not typically a problem for kids with phonological disorders?
They're not typically a problem for kids with phonological disorders, meaning that they consistently use the correct vowel.
Okay,
sorry about that. Thank you for clarifying that.
I thought that's what you meant, but I was thinking, okay, consistent.
Yeah.
Because one of the hallmarks.
We're analyzing every single word tonight, aren't
well,
we?
Well, I'm really thinking about it. Well, because one of the hallmarks of apraxic kids is they're so darn inconsistent on what they say and how they say it. So,
Might mess up a vowel a lot, and for one time they might say please like e, and one time they might say puh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've gotten the p, but holy cow, what happened to the vowel? What happened to the E? So,
mm-hmm.
And then the next time they try it, they might be E's. And then, they've gotten the E, and they've gotten the, you know, they've changed the please, you know, there's kind of that S really sounds like a Z there because it's after a vowel, and we usually, it's after that long vowel, and we voice that. So they've kind of gotten the consonant at the end, and they left the vowel in the middle, but there's no... What happened to the P? You know, so every time, not every time they say it, but they might say a word differently. You might notice two or three pronunciations, and they might get it pretty well as a single word, but then you try to put it with another word, and oh boy, it totally falls apart. Like you might have a kid that does more and can say the M pretty well and the vowel's pretty good, you know, pretty close to O. And then they even, you know, might have a little at the end that's from, you know, they're getting something that sounds a little bit like an R. But then you try to do it with more please and the M's gone. Or they go E's, you know, they've changed, they've taken the E from please and put it where the more goes. You know, that to me is going to be more likely a kid with apraxia than a kid with a phonological disorder.
And you're saying if I'm reading you right, a phonological kid is going to use the same pattern pretty much every time they say it.
Right. It's not going to be messed up
from
word to word. And the thing with a kid with apraxia, too, is when it starts to, it really falls apart when you go to phrases. I mean, they may say it pretty well. That's why I asked you about your little girl before that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you said she almost always leaves off the ending of a word.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to say, gosh, but does she get it when it's just a single word? You know, does she, you know, does
no,
she say
hat? Oh, Laura, we could have a caller here.
Oh, good.
Okay, I just tapped their little thing.
Hello, caller, are you there? Did you, push the microphone button?
Yeah.
Did it change? Did the little icon of the microphone, did it change?
Caller on air.
Hello, caller. Hello. I wonder if they're still there.
It says caller on air, but...
Caller, are you there? Okay.
Caller 862.
Hello, are you there? You're on the
air. Are you wanting... Caller 862?
Yes.
I'm sorry,
Hi, good evening. Okay, that's okay. No, I'm just listening in. I've got an interpreter here. I'm talking to you through an interpreter.
Oh,
okay. I'm deaf. I'm a deaf person, and so I'm talking to you through an interpreter, and it's just really interesting. You know, being a deaf person, I've had a lot of speech therapy throughout my life, and now as my kids and grandkids are coming along, you know, it's just kind of interesting listening to the, you know, your show a little bit. And the ums and the practices and everything that I had to grow up with, you know, and the years and years that I've had. And so it's been, I'm thankful to have speech therapists in my life that I have had for so many years. As children, it's interesting to have that, you know, from my world, I would think that pretty much just deaf kids are the ones who need speech therapy, but it's nice to hear that you guys are helping hearing kids as well.
Wow, what an interesting perspective. And I don't normally work with lots of children with hearing impairments because we have a wonderful program in Louisville, and those children are usually automatically referred to therapists who kind of specialize in children with hearing issues. So it's nice to have kind of that different perspective.
Oh, Louisville, okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah,
well, that's just interesting. I enjoy your show very much, and keep it up. Keep up the good work. Your program.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm out here in San Francisco, California myself is where I'm from.
Oh, wow. Well, nice to have you listening. Thank you for listening tonight.
Needed.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. See, and that's so out of my realm of practice that I don't really think about that.
Yeah, I have never worked with that. Well, I've had some kids with some hearing loss, but never a deaf child.
Right. And I've had children with hearing loss. I have a little girl right now who's at significant risk for hearing loss. We talked to her mom a few weeks ago when we were having our parent success stories. So that's certainly something we think about. And one of the first things we do with children with language and speech and language delays or disorders is we send them to rule out hearing loss as a cause for that. So, but we haven't really talked about that much on the show, and actually we probably aren't because it's not really our area of expertise. But if we get lots of callers or lots of interest in that, Kate, we'll have to dig up a speech pathologist who is more well-versed
in
that.
We get one at Louisville Deaf Oral who would be, we're fortunate to be in a big enough market where that's available. So we don't really.
Yeah, and we did have Dr. Windmill. We did have Sue on a few weeks ago.
Right.
To talk about that, but as far as therapy techniques and analyzing the speech of those children, that's not something that you and I would do every day. So, but we certainly appreciate any listener who continues to listen in. So that was a great call.
Yeah.
All right. So back to our topic with phonological disorders and kind of the differences between apraxia and phonological disorders. We talked about vowel sounds. We've talked about children with apraxia are much more likely to have inconsistent errors, meaning sometimes they say it right, sometimes they say it wrong, sometimes they leave off the consonants, sometimes they change the vowels. And again, it's not that they can't say it correctly ever, it's that when they do try to say it a lot of the times, it's not the same pronunciation that they used before. Whereas a kid with a phonological disorder might always say it wrong, but it's usually the same way every single time he tries to say it. And there's no big difference when he tries to combine it with another word. He always says it the same way and says it incorrectly, whereas an apraxic kid might mess it up and have three or four different versions of a word, and he's more likely to be able to get every single sound and say it correctly as a single word versus when he puts it into a phrase.
And that's common with a lot of the kids that I happen to suspect are apraxic. Once they start combining them, it's like, oh, no.
What happened
to
that?
Oh, here we go. Yeah, and yeah. We're so thrilled to get them talking at all. But then they start combining, which is what they are supposed to do. It does sometimes really frustrate the problem, but oh, well.
Right. Okay. So we've talked about the consistency. The other thing is, and I touched on this already, children who are apraxic, especially early on before they started therapy, they almost always also have a language disorder, meaning that they're not using the same number of words as other children their age. They're not trying to use the same length of utterance, meaning that, you know, you might have a three-year-old who still is at a 24-month-old language level because he's just now able to put a couple of phrases together, whereas a child with just strictly a phonological disorder, which, again, we've already talked about this exception, there's hardly a kid who is just straight black and white, but children with only a phonological disorder are much less likely as they age to also, okay, I'm saying this incorrectly.
They have delayed expressive language skills?
Right, yeah.
So they're combining words at probably a typical rate, you know. But
yeah, especially as they get older. Now, you really might have a two-year-old who's a late talker who does go on to be diagnosed with phonological disorder, who does have lots of patterns in what he says, and he does have a language disorder at two, because, again, we're talking about a specific child versus in general.
Mm-hmm.
But as a whole, children with apraxia early on always have language disorders, whereas a kid with just strictly a phonological disorder may have typically developing language. He's trying to say it. He's trying to talk in sentences. You just can't understand a word he says.
Right.
And he would say it the same way, whether he puts it with three words. Cookie might always be tui, but it's not. He's going to say it tui, whether he's pronouncing it as a single word or whether he's pronouncing it as part of a phrase. So that, to me, would be a big indicator that it's a phonological disorder, much more likely to be a phonological disorder than him having apraxia.
Right.
Okay. We talked about this last week, excuse me. And another diagnostic difference is children with apraxia often have lots of trouble while they're speaking just with the way that they move their mouths. So remember last week we spent a lot of time talking about groping,
right,
or scanning. They look like they don't know what to do with their mouth. And whereas a kid with a phonological disorder would be much more consistent with what he can do with his mouth. He really probably doesn't have any trouble blowing, whether you stick a birthday candle in front of him, which would be an automatic response, or whether you said to him, do this, blow. You know, and if he can do it and repeat that movement right back to you with no difficulty at all, he more than likely has a phonological disorder and not apraxia, because kids with those kinds of kids can use their mouths much more consistently and much more reliably and can imitate much, much better than children with a motor planning disorder. And I have seen those kids where, you know, even in my mind, if I'm thinking, okay, this looks like a motor planning thing, but then I start doing lots of oral motor stuff, and I say, here, do this with your tongue, and wiggle my tongue from side to side, and they can do it. And then I say, here, click your tongue, and they can do it. And then I say, oh, give me a kiss, pucker up, and they can do it. I think, well, he's not apraxic.
Yeah.
He can do all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And there's some examples of the DVD on there that where you see some kids really struggle to move their mouths in the way that I've asked them to do it. And for those kids, I think, okay, this is more likely apraxia or a motor planning problem, whereas you see some other kids who are just doing everything I ask them to do, but their speech still sounds terrible. You know, that's more likely a phonological disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another difference that I always look at is that children with apraxia usually have lots of difficulty imitating or repeating what you've said. So a kid with a phonological disorder might try to repeat you every single time you say it and be off, but sometimes kids with apraxia, especially at the beginning of therapy, can't do it at all. They just sit there and kind of look at you like, I don't know what you've asked me to do. I have no clue. I don't even know where to start with that. So especially at the very beginning of therapy, they have a big, big problem imitating. And that's always one question that I ask in the assessment, you know, with parents. How often does he imitate you? How often does he try to say what you've asked him to say? Or a parent may say, sometimes I'll hear him just kind of copy a word, but then when I ask him to turn around and do it again, he can't do it. And so that would be a big clue to me that it's more likely apraxia than a phonological disorder, because the phonological disorder kids really try, even though they may be off. You know, their sounds may not come out the same way. They still try a whole lot more versus a kid with apraxia. Do you see that, Kate?
Absolutely. And I would say that brings up that can't versus won't topic. And with me, with kids that I suspect are apraxic or those who have had formal diagnoses, I always point out, you know, it's really not a can't, won't thing with apraxic kids. He could at that moment, and he couldn't at that moment. Because I do hear a lot of parents with that say, well, he will do it every once in a while when he wants to, but he usually won't, like he's choosing not to. And
right.
You're, normally, if mom's telling me a specific situation where, do you know, listen to what he said, and, you know, and early on when they're barely talking at all, you know, he said balloon. And I said, really? Well, when did he say that? And normally it's when that heightened arousal was present and the kid was really excited. You know, we went into Walmart and he saw Thomas on the balloon and he said, balloon! You know, but when you're just saying, tell mommy balloon or tell Kate balloon, you may not get it. And, you know, it really isn't because he's choosing to be difficult or obstinate and just not say it. It's like, well, the proper pathway was not taken that time, and he didn't choose not to take it. It just didn't take that route, and he really can't do it. So it's more of a fluke when they do it early on, you know.
Right, and sometimes even therapists miss that.
I think, yeah.
I do, and I'll read a report, and they'll say he was non-participatory, and that to me sounds like they thought it was more of a behavior issue, like he wasn't even trying to imitate versus, oh, he just flat out can't do it. So you want to be careful with that. I have a little girl right now that I always stop myself on and think, because even I think, oh, my gosh, you just tried to say that a second ago. Why can't you try that again? And she gets this look. She just gets this look on her face, and it's not that she's distracted. It's not that she's moving on. She just sits there and looks at me like, Laura, if I could do it, I would.
Yeah.
But I can't. You know, it's just this little look, and I'm not going to say her name. But, you know, I'm going to think about this little girl forever with how she is right now, because it's so apparent to me.
Right. And I think as you work with so many kids as we do, you do get to be a pretty good read on can't versus won't. And you also see that, gee, you really have to have them kind of in that optimal place where they're doing their absolute best. And sometimes that's usually, I usually think with the kids I see, you know, they kind of need a warm-up period where, and I always kind of start with things that are the easiest for them, you know, so that you're kind of getting their little minds working, their little bodies working, and, you know, then they hit their running speed and they're doing their absolute best, and then it just kind of taxes their little brains and their little bodies, and they hit the wall, and boy, don't expect too much after that. But when you see that, you kind of get to know which it is, you know?
Right, you do. Or a kid that's turning away from me screaming, no, I think, okay, that's a won't. You know, that's when he won't do it. Or a kid that's shaking his head no at me, or being some kind of, you know, there's some kind of behavioral defiance there. You know, they're smacking me and running away. You know, that, even sometimes kids, when they can't do it, do that. But that, to me, is more indicative of a, you know, I won't do it right now versus that little look that I get from this little girl, like, oh, I could do it if, you know, I would do it if I could, but I just can't right now. You know, and that brings us to the other point that you're talking about, that kind of just right place when they're kind of in the zone. I love it when I get kids there in therapy. You never get them there when they're sick, when they're hungry, or when they're sleepy either. So, and today the little girl that I'm talking about was probably sleepy and hungry when I saw her. So, you know, we never really got to that place. And so she never, you know, she just couldn't do it. Her little system couldn't cooperate and pop those, even words that she has tried before, she couldn't really do today.
The other one I hear
parents,
I'm sorry, I'm...
Go ahead.
Is when, and this is typically with kids that I suspect are apraxic, they'll say a word pretty close one time, and then the other 8 times I try and get them to say it, mile it, form, cue it, sign it, blah, blah, blah. They're way off. You know, it doesn't sound anything like the one great time I got him to say it, or the 2 times. And parents at that point sometimes think he's choosing not to say it correctly. And I think,
and that would be, yeah, nothing's further from the truth.
Yeah, why would he do
that?
That
really, yeah, those are the kids that really can't do it. It's when they can do it one time right, you know, why wouldn't they? And especially when they're kids that respond to praise and they're beaming from ear to ear, and then you get them to do it again, and then it's off, and then they still
He's just not trying. And I'm thinking, well, yes, he is. He's giving it his, and I always say that's his best effort right there. You know, that right now, this second, that was his best he could do. I mean, I don't think that most 24 to 36-month-old children consciously think, I'm going to give her one right word, and then I'm going to, you know.
I'm going to really mess with Kate
mess
today.
Mess up all the other words. Every other time I try and say ball, it's going to come out duh, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes parents really do think that. And I think, I don't know.
Or they'll say, he's just playing you today. You're right. Mm-hmm. That cognitively, they can't come up with that.
No, I don't think they get that deception that early that they're going to do that.
You know, or you do have a kid, you know, who twinkly-eyed, you know, might try to do it to fool you, you know, and think, oh, that was so funny last time. But that's totally different than the kid who so thinks he did it right.
Right.
You know.
And he's looking at you like, that was good, wasn't it? And you're like, oh.
Yeah. That's what I mean. They really still want that praise, and they don't understand why their mom is going, oh, come on. That was terrible. He didn't even try. Yeah.
I know, thinking he really is trying. We just
He's
have to wait for the stars to align again, and it will come back. But, in the beginning, they can be pretty far off. But it is confusing. You know, I can see why parents would think, he did it once. Why can't he do it again?
Right, yeah. And
I mean, it kind of makes sense, but it just doesn't really work that way. So.
I know, but once I get it once, I kind of do think, okay, I am going to be able to get that word again.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to have to get him in the right place that you so eloquently talked about. You know, kind of get their motor running, kind of get them going, get them primed, get them ready. Then you're more likely to hear it again than if not.
And over time, as they've gotten more therapy and parents work with them and everything, normally those are, you know, they do become fairly consistent. But in
they
the beginning,
do, yeah.
it's just a magical thing. It comes and then you have to wait again until you've really worked on it, and then they have
right.
it. Yeah. So.
Right.
Well, Miss Laura, I believe we've made it through another show. This was kind of a confusing topic. It's pretty technical stuff, but
it was. And you know, next week we're going to move on to the therapy piece. What you do for a kid with motor planning issues and what you do for kids with phonological disorders. And again, this is where we concentrate and where I don't want to say we're better at, but it's kind of our thing. And, again, we're not having to sort out all the layers and not talk about all the exceptions. We're going to go straight to therapy stuff next week, which is what I think we don't get enough of from these kinds of shows and from reading topics and parenting things. So but we're going to that next week, to the bread and butter of how you fix it. So
okay.
We'll talk to you next Thursday. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.